right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the KE Report Weekend Show. And as promised, we're now switching our focus to the resource sector because, well, it was a busy week for a lot of our regular guests on the show. In Toronto, we had the Metals Investor Forum. And at the beginning of this last week, we had the PDAC conference, so the largest resource investment conference. In this segment, to recap those conferences and talk about the overall metals stock sector, which had a nice bounce again this week, we're chatting with Brian Lenny, founder and editor of the Junior Stock Review. Brian, let's start off with those conferences. You were in Toronto, you attended the Metals Investor Forum, you also attended the start of the PDAC. What did you see there, Brian? What was your general takeaway from those conferences?
Well, first, thanks for having me, guys. You know, overall, it was a great weekend or 4 days in Toronto for MIF and PDAC. I think I can answer that question from two different perspectives. I think first, from a sentiment perspective, I think that it was still a little bit light from a retail point of view. And that's sort of after spending 4 days in Vancouver in January, I was really intrigued about what I might see, you know, a couple months later with the gold price being as high as it was. I was hoping that I would see a big retail contingent. And I don't necessarily think it was there. But what I would say is that the people that were there were new to the sector and were asking some great questions. And so the quantity may not be there, but the quality seems to be ticking up. And I think that's a great thing to see. And that's probably reflective of where we are in the market, you know, the very early stages of bull market and a sign of good things to come, I think. From my own perspective, again, I think this is probably the best PDAC I've had and MIF conference I've had from a meeting perspective, from, you know, the quality. And again, it mixed in with the early stages of a bull market. I think the optimism, that sentiment rubs off. And so I don't think I've been this optimistic about the market in a long time. And that's a great thing to have.
Well, Brian, did you notice any trends as far as the companies that were there or as far as what investors were interested in, as far as, is there more focus on just gold since gold has done so well? Was there any interest in copper, silver, some of the other metals? Was there a disdain for uranium companies? What kind of vibe did you get as far as the what was in and what was out?
I think that gold definitely stole the show at both places, both conferences, and rightfully so. I think that's the best opportunity for investors that are looking to deploy money into the junior resource sector. I think that, you know, gold probably represents the, maybe not the net most upside from a metal price standpoint, but probably offers the best risk to reward, meaning that the downside risk, I think, in the gold price is probably pretty low. I mean, the upside, who knows how high it could really go. And so from that perspective, investing in the developers, explorers, producers, I think is a great thing and a great, if you can pick the right companies again, it's probably where the best risk to reward is. Next to that, you know, the silver bulls are always there. I've heard numerous people talk about silver's next. I'd like to think so. There's definitely some exposure in the junior stock for premium portfolio to silver, but you just never know. You know, silver has definitely changed over the years. It certainly is more of an industrial metal. And as such, its dynamics are that much different from gold. Outside of that, the in terms of energy and the other commodities, not a lot of talk, you know, at least around me anyways, critical metals is definitely always a big topic, but I didn't hear very much on that front. And maybe that's a sign of a bottom or a sign of where the opportunity is in the market, considering all that focus is on gold. But like I said, I still think if you were looking to deploy money right now, you'd be foolish to not have some exposure to gold. But, you know, as such, you know, we were talking offline there. I just made a new pick in copper. And with the future price hovering up around $5 a pound, sort of, you know, in a stealth mode, because I don't hear anybody talking about it, maybe there's some opportunity there, especially with all this chaos created by tariffs and bad blood between countries moving forward. Maybe that's the opportunity.
Brian, I want to revisit a comment you made there that this could be early stage of a bull market for especially precious metals. And look, you are right. The focus for resource investors, especially on the stock side, has been very much to gold. Gold has stole the show because it keeps on hitting all-time highs and just keeps on moving higher. we haven't seen the whole revaluation of all the gold stocks, but a lot of producers, a lot of mid-tiers have done very well over the last year, because it was a year ago at PDAC when the gold price truly started to break out and really hasn't looked back. But we can also go back 10 years and the gold price is up almost three times. So when you're talking early stage of a bull market, are you referring to the smaller stocks that haven't moved, or how are you putting that time frame on it?
Right. Oh, so when I say that, I mean like that tide that rises all boats. My experience with gold bull markets primarily are 2016 and 2020. And in both cases, for about 6 maybe to 8 months, that push in the precious metals, mainly gold equities, was sort of unparalleled in my experience. And it was something that, you know, you saw all share prices across the board, no matter if it was your mediocre or, you know, bottom basement companies to the best of the best, were moving up. And that's what I'm sort of alluding to in terms of like a full out bull market, because I think you're right. If you picked right, which I did last year, like the junior stock premium portfolio was up, had an average weighted return over 150%. The last time the premium portfolio did that was in 2020, and that was in an all out bull market. So you could say from a performance wise that it's sort of paralleling that. But what I will say is that definitely from my perspective, and I think this is any investor could sort of have this experience, that it's a constant learning experience. And I made some mistakes myself, but I made a lot of good moves over the last year and a half, and that was precipitated on the back of failure. And so I learned from a lot of my mistakes and positioned myself really well with the newsletter and my own investments. And so I was able to reap the rewards in what would, I would say, most would consider it would be a sort of medium year. So again, if you pick right, you can still have good performance. And it really, if you look at the way I constructed the portfolio, and again, this is something that we were sort of talking offline, the reason why I got into expiration the way I did, if you look at my the premium portfolio right now, there's good exposure to expiration, but it's expiration exposure through prospect generation. And I think I've picked the cream of the crop when it comes to prospect generators. And all those companies are going to see multi-million dollars worth of expiration, mostly drilling, in last year and then into 2025. And so from that perspective, when you look at expiration, if discoveries are made, it doesn't really matter where you are in the cycle. You will get paid if they make a good enough discovery. And so that's sort of the balance that I've taken in the portfolio and why it performed last year. And I expect it could do even better this year. And if you look at the performance, really, it almost done Q1 here. And it's kind of keeping up the pace that it did last year. So portfolio construction can help you no matter where you are in the bull market. But of course, when you get into those bull market opportunities or settings, it's a tide that rises all boats. And that's the sort of what everybody, an investor, no matter where your experience is, can make some money. And I just hope people last to sort of experience that, because it can really, you know, set you up with a nice buffer for that next X amount of years of your investing career.
Well, Brian, let's pull on that thread a little bit, because when I think of the Junior Stock Review and the letter you put out, I consider you one of the best voices in the sector covering the development space as far as companies that maybe are a little more advanced and they have resources defined and economic studies, but you've gone down the food chain into more exploration than in the past. And you're doing it, like you say, through some exposure to prospect generators. Now, prospect generators are a charged topic. Some people hate them. Some people love them. Rick Rule swears by them. Other people think, oh, you know, they got a lot of pieces of a lot of Prada projects, but no main flagships. Some companies, though, do have 100% owned properties that they're drilling. So parse out how you separate the wheat from the chaff in the prospect generator space, and what kinds of companies are what the hallmarks you look for in a prospect generator.
Sure. So first and foremost, I think the overarching point of investing in a prospect generator is to reduce risk, to protect your downside. That's sort of the overarching theme. From there, I think it's just like any other company out there, you have to make sure you pick the right ones. It's not a ubiquitous buy that you buy any prospect generator out there. I think I would tend to agree that probably about 75, 80% of the prospect generators out there are boring and are sort of meaningless, because they have, you know, 20, 30% of projects that just don't have any potential. The difference is if you can find the companies that have already made a major discovery or are probably on the cusp of it because they've used their geological acumen to identify high potential targets and then went out and or sought out, you know, companies with big checkbooks to explore them, I think you're at a huge advantage. And again, if you look at the companies I'm invested in, I'll talk about, you know, Canorland Minerals. These guys, especially when I started buying the company, you know, in the 60s and 70 cent range, they had already made the Renault discovery. They had, this is going back to last year, they converted their 20% position in Renault or Frotet into a 4% NSR. And again, if you do some simple geometry, and again, this is very super rough and you don't want to put too much emphasis on this, but I can totally see how it's a multi-million ounce deposit. Therefore, a 4% NSR, even with a buyback down to 3.5 or 3.2, whatever the buyback is, you're still looking at something that's probably worth at least $100 million. So you are buying Canorland for right now market cap of around $100 million. Therefore, you get $30 million in cash. You get $36 million in exploration spend in 2025. And I would say you've got arguably one of the best exploration teams in the business for finding gold undercover. So you look at how they've set up that company, you see the opportunity. And so to me, that's a no-brainer, or as close to a no-brainer as you get in this crazy sector that we invest in, speculate in. It's protecting your downside. It's picking companies that are selling for less than they're worth, but that selling for less than they're worth, it's actual value that you're buying. It's actual discoveries, or it's actual potential that you see in that project portfolio. And that potential is going to be tested because they've been able to attract smart money. They've been attract, you know, those senior mining companies to deploy and test that potential. And I think that's all you can sort of ask for. And so it's that balance between prospect generation or exploration and development that I've tried to take in the portfolio in case I'm wrong about where the direction of the market is headed. Because I thought to myself, you know, these developers and what I've experienced is if the metal price isn't with you, it's much harder for you to realize value from the market in those cases. Therefore, you need something in the portfolio that sort of can drive alpha regardless of where the market is headed. And to me, exploration is the only way to do that. And again, I want to take it a step further and say, I want to you protect my downside, and then prospect generation fits. So that's sort of how I look at the market. It's sort of how that the portfolio has been constructed.
Well, and it makes sense with a prospect generator. The partners you want are the larger mining companies. They are not as subject to market swings like juniors are that would back away from assets simply because they can't raise money. But look, Canorland, we've talked about it before. The company listed back in 2021, they already had big companies as partners, right? These guys did a great job, even as a private company, attracting large companies. So that, in a way, I agree with you, is kind of the no-brainer for prospect generators. But I don't think there are that many prospect generators that even have that Rolodex that Canorland does with those type of partners. Are there any other prospect generators that also stand out to you that, again, have those majors, maybe that haven't even made a discovery yet, quite like Canorland? Canorland's much further advanced with that royalty, with discoveries, but any other prospect generators that you see that have those at least similar partners to Canorland?
Absolutely. And from my portfolio right now, I've got four or five in the portfolio, and each of those have exposure to the largest mining companies in the world. To give you another name, and I think it's actually quite interesting, their share price hasn't moved a tremendous amount considering what position they're in, but a company, let's say like Inflection Resources, they've been able to attract AngloGold Ashanti. They're exploring in the Macquarie Belt in Australia. They've got, I would say, arguably the best deal with a senior mining company out there in terms of how JV projects will be explored and developed. If you look at the breakdown, they basically have at the phase one level, you've got, it's $7 million that needs to be spent. And then from there, projects get picked for phase two. And in phase two, you have another $7 to $10 million that's spent in phase two. And then they go to a phase four, which is a feasibility study and the issuance of a 2% NSR on the project. So these guys, essentially, if they discover something in phase one, two, or three, and they develop it up to phase four, Inflection is carried all the way up to a PFS, which is a huge deal. And especially if you look what they're looking for in the Macquarie Belt, They're looking for these large porphyry discoveries in line with, let's say, Cadia, which is a massive porphyry discovery in the Macquarie Belt. And again, if they got something like that, you're talking hundreds of millions of dollars in development costs and exploration costs to get to the point of a PFS, which means, I think, and again, I don't think I'm stepping out and being too crazy, but it means that if they make a discovery, pretty much inflection is going to get taken out. And again, that is, you don't see deals like that with senior mining companies very much. But this is the importance of thinking big, you know, big properties, big structures, big potential. It doesn't speak to saying 100% you're going to make a discovery, but you've set yourself up that if you do, you're probably going to you're going to discover something of significance. And this is exactly what the senior mining companies are looking for, and is why a company like Anglo Gold, you know, decided to do this deal with Inflection, because it's such a good idea. And the track of land that they got in the Macquarie Belt is sort of unparalleled. So again, if you look, and this is sort of a teaser, because I do think I've done a very good job with the newsletter, grabbing the best of the best prospect generation companies out there. Each of the companies that I have in the portfolio have exposure to that, and in their own nuanced way. So again, you know, it's a, right now with the market the way it is, it's a stock picker's market. And I think I've done a great job in sort of assembling the portfolio to gain that alpha if they make a discovery. And the other side is, if we continue to have this hotness in the gold market or across the sector, those development companies that I have also have the right exposure to bring that alpha to the portfolio. And again, that's what I think you want to look for. The only other topic that we could kind of cover is portfolio allocation. You can have exposure to exploration, or you can have exposure to prospect generators and developers, but you can also change the allocation. So you can have your investment. Let's say I'm headed to see Dublilos, AbraSilver's Dublilos in April. AbraSilver's been a huge winner for me. AbraSilver still represents roughly, I think, around 11.5% of my portfolio. That is a company that may not be a 10 bagger from where it is today, especially if the silver price or the gold price doesn't continue to run. But I could see it definitely double from here. And if I doubled a position that's 11.5% or 12% of my portfolio, I can still make the same difference or the same margin of profit as I could if you took an exploration company or a prospect generator that's a 2% or a 3% allocate a portion of the portfolio, and they make a discovery that brings them 3 or 4 times. So you see, like, portfolio allocation can also be a way that you protect yourself and gain some alpha if you want to go into the riskier companies, even outside of prospect generation.
Man, Brian, that's such an interesting point. And I'm so glad you brought up how you do that inside of your portfolio, the allocation, the weighting, because I have the same philosophy personally, that some of the better companies could double or triple, but if they're a bigger position size, that would be like a smaller company that's a smaller weighting going up 3x, 5x. You can still have that same kind of overall alpha in your portfolio, but you're also managing risk at the same time. I kind of want to stick with Prospect Generator on just one more question here, though, and that is, there's a couple different pathways. It's not a one-size-fits-all space. So there are prospect generator companies that do play for the takeover. So like what you're saying with Inflection Resources, or even their sister company Headwater, that's doing the same kind of model. Yeah, they hope that they get taken over by the major. But there are prospect generator companies that also hold 100% owned properties that they drill themselves, and they're hoping they don't get taken over. They're hoping to sell the project. And then the third model would be what you see in the royalty space for prospect generators like Elemental Altus, the Altus part of it, or like EMX or Altius, which I know you're very familiar with Altius. They all started as prospect generators, optioned the properties off, kept the royalty. And in the end, EMX and Altius and the Altus Elemental merger now, they're all royalty companies that use the prospect generator model to grow. So I guess between those different flavors, do you like the ones that are playing for the takeover? Do you like the ones that hold 100% properties? Or do you like that some of them become royalty companies over time?
That's a really good point, Chad. There definitely is a differentiation between those, like, various, you know, they're like hybrids, right? And I do actually, and I would consider it, it's like, because I see it from both sides, I would consider the hybrids to be like, let's say, Ridgeline. Ridgeline's done exceptionally well. They're in the portfolio. They've got a ton of potential, 3 projects that are JV'd, 2 that are 100% owned. And when I first made the investment decision, like, I've known Chad for a while now, but I got to invest in the 12-cent placement last year. I thought that was tremendous value. And that's when they only had basically the 3 projects, or it was 4 projects, but the 3 main ones that we're seeing spend on them. And that was with South 32 and, of course, Nevada Gold Mines. I would say that they stand out that with that hybrid model, because Chad is going to go after their new Atlas project. He's going to drop some holes in there. I think they're a great low risk hybrid model because, you know, Chad's experienced the other side of things where, you know, when Ridgeline first started, they were not a hybrid or they were not a prospect generation company. They were a full out sole explorer. And it's super tough, even when you have projects like Selena that have so much potential, this CRD potential at depth. And they took a couple swings and they did a couple 700 meter holes. They hit some mineralization, but the market still didn't want to give them any attributable value to that. Maybe because of how hard it is. If you start thinking about how much money needs to be spent to effectively drill projects, especially big projects with big potential, maybe the market rightly discounted it. So he sort of on the fly switched the model over the last year and a half. And I think he's put him in such a great position, especially now that he wants to go take a few swipes at Atlas on his 100% ground for cheap. He's going to put in a few RC holes and he's going to test that Carlin type gold mineralization potential. And to me, that's worth doing. And I wouldn't even be opposed to companies like Knorrland doing the same thing. And I'm pretty sure that Zach has at least one hole planned at their what's it, Canacross in Alaska. I believe he's going to drop at least one or two holes into the Skarn target that they have there. I like that. I sort of like that. You know, they've built a really good business and really good downside protection with their JV projects. And then something that they feel really passionate about and that's not going to blow the bank because they do have a good treasury. I think it's worth testing their geological acumen and see if they're correct in their assumptions, especially like that Tanacross project was last JV'd with Antofagasta. And I can remember the guys talking about, you know, this Skarn target being so important to them, but Antofagasta didn't want to drill it. And so it was almost like a blessing for them to leave. And now they get it back and they get to put those couple holes in and really test, you know, that potential that they saw from the outside looking in. So, you know, I think that most prospect generators need to focus on JVing projects first and protecting downside from that perspective. From there, once they have a little bit of success and there's a little bit more downside protection and enough spend going on in news flow to sort of drive that share price forward, if they hit something, then they can go out there and take more chances and kind of do that hybrid model where, you know, they have a couple 100% owned projects, but again, it's not going to destroy the company if they miss. So yeah, I don't know if I fully answered the question, but that's sort of how I look at it. And so the companies that are in the portfolio, again, there's four or five of them. They sort of are in that realm of having either full prospect generation or maybe they have a few projects or one project in particular that they're touching on that's 100% owned.
Well, and to your point about having some of those JVs already in place, it helps to cover simple G&A costs too for a lot of these companies. If they are the operator of these exploration programs, they get a little piece of the spend and that helps, again, protect that downside. Brian, what about developers then? Let's switch to a little bit higher up the food chain. You always focus on developers. You love diving into economic studies and creating your models. There's been a number of developers that have moved very well in the last year. There's also a number of development companies that haven't moved, but I also think that there's so many more companies that are now considering themselves developers simply because, well, that's the stage in the market they are. They have resources, and right now they're kind of stuck trying to figure out, should they expand their resource? Should they act like they're actually going to build something? How are you viewing the developer space?
I think you want to be really picky on what you buy. And I do think the cream of the crop basically moved last year. But there is still a few companies out there that are showing some great delta in terms of price to value. And so I think you want to stay, again, who knows where the market is headed. And again, I would say that my preference is towards saying that we're in the early stages of bull market and we could really see a huge push this year. I truly believe that's probably where we're most likely headed. But if we aren't, then you still want to make sure that you're picking the sort of best companies that you can that have a realistic price to value ratio or delta that can be closed through market recognition. And you're looking for size, maybe potential, like in terms of X factors. A lot of these developers, of course, they've got usually a core or that critical mass where they can do an economic study and it shows decent economics and you could plausibly say that this would go into production because of that critical mass, but maybe the exploration, it's there's some really good targets that are somewhere else on the property or within, let's say, a 30 kilometer radius if it's another project outside of it, that realistic, if they made a discovery, could be added on, sort of that, like that hub and spoke idea with a production facility. So that X factor that sort of separates them from the other companies. And if you look at the portfolio again, that's sort of how I've picked them. These companies have some sort of X factor that separates them from the other developers, and that the market is either oblivious to or has highly discounted it. And I can think of a number of examples, but I don't want to give up the whole portfolio with examples. If people are interested, you know, I hope they'll consider subscribing, but that's how I'm looking at it. And I think, you know, again, going back to last year, that was the key to companies like G Mining or Montage, why those were, you know, 300% wins in the portfolio, is because they had X factors that the market wasn't really considering or giving them value for. You know, in G Mining's case, the Gignacs, the power of G Mining Services that took Tocantinzinho, which is definitely not a top tier project, but they put it into production on time and on budget. And then they went out and bought Oko West. You know, this is what you get with the best of the best people. And I think the market discounted that. On Montage's case, you had close to a 5 million ounce deposit that the Lundins were involved in, and they were listed on everybody's corporate decks that they saw. Yet nobody cared until the Lundins came out publicly and really made a statement by, you know, how they sort of changed the company, and then the share price soared. So, you know, there's numerous examples of that out there. And then there's sort of numerous examples of companies that kind of ho-hum, that there isn't necessarily that thing that separates them. And that's what happens in a stock picker's market, is you have to be able to find those things. And of course, if we are headed to a bull market, then probably everything will go up. And so it won't matter quite as much.
Well, Brian, just along that line of thinking, as far as looking for the X factors or looking for ways to kind of reimagine a project or find satellite deposits or, you know, do something different. Sometimes companies have changed the mining method from open pit to underground or vice versa. So sometimes it just takes looking at it with a fresh set of eyes. You've already kind of teased that you're going down to see the Diablillos project from Abra Silver. Think about what a step change it was from them. They had a Colto known deposit, good enough to put into production, but nobody was really interested. Then they find the Jack Zone, which is this high grade near surface area, totally new area, spends 18 months drilling it out. They bring in Kinross, they bring in Central Puerto, and now they're moving towards a feasibility study and going to cash in on the RIGI laws down in Argentina. That it was a step change for the company. Do you go through all these different companies you see at PDAC and look for the companies that are doing something new, something different, a new interpretation, or have a new angle on an old story? Because a lot of people get mesmerized by new stories, but sometimes the old stories were the new stories from 10 years ago. They're still good. So how do you look at that?
Yeah, it's a good point. That typically can be where you find a lot of value, is in the rejigs of these companies, especially when you have management changes. And then going back to Abra Silver, which was formerly Abra Plata, there's a couple of things there. It's a story that sort of got destroyed by turmoil with the management team. This is going back to 2017, 2018, if I remember correctly. Turmoil with the management team, Argentina being sort of a basket case jurisdiction. They had a lack of cash. The summation of those three things brought their market cap down to, I think, sub 10 million. And of course, they had a resource. They had all these other things sort of going for them. And then they combined with Aethon Minerals, John Miniotis and his team, and sort of the influence of the Altius guys come in, and the story was completely revamped. And actually, it's funny because I was talking to some of the Altius people, and they were talking about the Jack Zone, how before that deal was sort of consummated, that was an area where they thought a lot of potential was. So it's the culmination of that step change with new people coming in, a new eye on the story, a new way to develop. But then when things just get super cheap, it becomes almost a no-brainer at some points, as long as you have the fortitude to sort of, in that case, you know, put your money to work in Argentina, where at the time where, you know, you could have lost everything, you know, even though it was cheap, it could still have gone down cheaper. So, you know, definitely the rejigs are a big part of how I look at it. But again, it's a story-by-story basis, and you're definitely looking at those things that the market is missing. And most likely, I think you bring up the point rightly, is that these older stories going to get pushed to the back. People already discount them, but those new eyes can make such a difference. And it's a, I'll bring up an example I'm not invested in, but could be the same thing. You look what Hyodon is doing with Corex, that project that they put into the rebranding of Corex. Again, I forget the name, but you're basically talking the rebranding of a project that's been around for at least a decade. And, you know, obviously Hyodon had a huge amount of success already in the gold market. And so I give him the benefit of the doubt that he could probably do it in the copper market too, but he's going after a deposit that's very well known already. So he's got the market probably against him to a certain degree, which may make that project that much more appetizing for investors looking for value.
All right, Brian, you've given us a lot to consider here. Again, in this whole bigger picture theme of the market is running. It has been running for over a year now, but the breakouts have been happening in this last year ever since last PDAC. And yes, it has been very much a stock picker's market, but at least it's been a wider stock picker's market there, where there has been a lot of companies moving strongly in this last year. And yes, a lot of the focus has been on gold, which I guess rightfully so. That is the metal that has been drastically outperforming in terms of all-time highs on a consistent basis. As long as that continues, man, oh man, you probably are going to be right that we are going to get to that stage where it's a re-rate across the board and all these stocks move. Still helps to be in the best ones, but also very much sounds like look for some of these stocks that haven't moved yet. Again, Brian Lenny, founder and editor of the Junior Stock Review. Brian, it's always great having you on the show. And everyone, thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. Please be sure to go back through our website, podcast, and YouTube channel. Just search DKE Report. You can listen to all our daily editorials and the full weekend show posting. Also, please hit like, hit subscribe, leave us your comments. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.